You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm here with Jonathan Carroll, who for me is a recent and entirely pleasurable discovery. The book that brought him to my attention came to me in the mail from Avon. It's in paperback. It's called Bones of the Moon, but it's the first of a series of books, the second of which is called Sleeping in Flames, and the third of which is called A Child Across the Sky, recently published by Doubleday. And, you know, as a bookworm, it's almost embarrassing to me to, be brought face on to a writer I haven't known about. And usually when I do, I assume somehow that I'm not going to like the books, that there must be a reason why I hadn't been told before, and it's because these books are secretly not of bookworm quality. But it was such a great pleasure to read Bones of the Moon. They're fantastical, odd, scary, funny, surrealist, Dadaistic, and anarchic books, which gave me great pleasure. And so the anticipation of meeting Jonathan Carroll was enormous, and welcome.
Thank you very much.
You've been writing for, what, there's five books now?
There's five with a six coming out next summer, yeah.
And how long has that been? When did the first one come out?
First one came out about 79 or 80, about 10 years.
And I think that just now you're starting to be discovered in America, although in England and in Germany, you are a, what, house specialty or a guilty pleasure? What's the
word that everybody seems to use with a half smile on their face is cult, which I think in this country has a worse connotation than it does elsewhere. The books here are less popular because my old argument is that the American, both reading public and bookseller, has great difficulty putting my books in a category, so they become sort of radioactive to them. What is this? And since we can't say that it's psychology or surreal or fantasy or horror or whatever, they say we don't know what to do with it, and it goes and hides someplace on an obscure shelf.
Well, it's sort of an odd thing because what I love most about the books is how disturbingly off-centered they are. You never know what direction they're going to take next or what tonality is going to come across. And as you continue to read, it's really a great pleasure to discover not the imaginary characters going from book to book, this happens all the time, but the real characters are met again from book to book, and one discovers new aspects or facets of them, so that there's a grounded reality and then an extraordinary, you know, phantasmagoria that accompanies each book. What I like best, I guess, is the experimental quality of the writing. I think what I fear, and please, you know, slap me in the face if you need to, is that these books will become immensely popular and that, you know, and that the people who like experimental writing will start saying, oh, well, he's nothing but a popular pleaser.
Isn't that's so American, you know? It's like, it's like you're pushed to succeed, but succeed means you fall off a cliff into the valley of drugstore books or supermarket books and this and that. I don't understand that. I never have been able to understand it, in the sense that we all, as Americans, are looking towards successful people, and yet when you get there or someone gets there, we look at them with a kind of frown on our face.
Well, because in many cases, it's not that something has gotten to the point of popularity. It's usually that what's popular in America is of a depressingly low and unthrilling level, and that intellectuals, for better or worse, don't feel at home with what, you know, has become of the popular imagination.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, I think that if you look at a writer like Le Carré, who's a really good writer, I mean, the thing is, you read John Le Carré for the kind of books that he writes, but what often the intellectuals say is, oh, well, it's only a crime or a spy novel. But that's exactly what he sets out to do, to write a spy novel, and more power to him. Why not allow him to write a wonderful spy novel? The constant comment you hear about things like that is, well, he's not Conrad. And I don't think he's trying to be Conrad. He's trying to be a wonderfully adept spy novelist who does it better than anyone else. There's a whole bunch of these guys around who are quote-unquote popular, but they get the frown from the intellectual community simply because they sell lots of books.
I think the intellectual community is perfectly happy for them to be well-loved and embraced and kissed by others. It's just that, you know, the idea that the intellectual community should be giving their imprimatur to things that aren't their first loves. I mean, inevitably, you know, the books that catch on with intellectuals are going to be of a strange
bent. Obscure, yeah.
We're a minority in this country.
Except, to me, I know that a lot of the intellectuals that I know, they don't all read Roland Barthes every day. Sometimes I like to sit down and read, let's say, a good spy novel. And because of that, I think it should, this funny language I'm using, it should be allowed that the guy just do his thing and be applauded for it, and that's great, and period, no more. Instead of, oh, I mean, you have other cases in which writers, let's go back to what you said before, have reached a certain level of popularity, and then they get bad. They don't do it again. They've shot their shot. And I think that's valid to say, well, when Jones became popular, he became less good. You have every right to attack Jones for that, because that's what criticism is for. But the fact that Jones gets better, but he continues to write spy novels, for example, I don't like that.
I'm talking to Jonathan Carroll, the author of Bones of the Moon, Sleeping in Flames, A Child Across the Sky. And because you will, I think, be a new name to most of my listeners, I want to give the idea of what kind of thing they're likely to find. How would you describe, if you were to on some odd occasion, the kind of book you do?
Well, you know, the thing is, I've always shied away from describing them, because as soon as you describe something and put a word on it, it becomes that. And at the risk of sounding pompous, there's a very well-known critic in Germany who wrote an article about the books recently, in which he said, for want of a better term, Carroll writes hyperfiction. And he continued along the line of other people who write hyperfiction. And
who were they?
People like Steve Erickson and T.C. Boyle and who else? There was quite a few of these people, and which I think is fine, because there needs be a category for people who are writing, let's use your term, off-center. And, I mean, he also mentioned Philip Dick, but I have troubles with him in a certain way. But the other people, if we are in a category, that's okay. I mean, if you look up the word hyper in the dictionary, one of the definitions is, it's things that are taking place beyond three dimensions. And whatever those dimensions are, I think that's our rich soil. I've been reading Boyle's novel, The World's End, recently. And, I mean, he's doing 10 things in there. Now, luckily, he's applauded by the literary community, but he could just as easily not be, because of the dangerous stuff he's up to. Whether you like his work or not, he's up to dangerous stuff as far as traditional literary standards are concerned. Erickson, too, whose work I like very much. But I like that term, hyperfiction.
There are strong elements of fantasy, but not the, at least for what I know, the sword and sorcery kind, or the things that are in science fiction stores. It's a kind of libidinal free play place that I associate, say, with the Oz books and fantasy lands where anything can happen, which in your work become sort of Dadavilles, in which imaginary inventions, perfumed hammers, for instance, come into existence just because the words can be placed next to one another. I described to someone on the phone yesterday that it was like watching popcorn popping, that there was a kind of constant and fertile inventiveness that's funny just because of its constant, ongoing, jazzy nature. Are you Dada in that fantasy vein?
Well, Dada to me means essentially uninhibited, and in that sense, when I wrote Bones of the Moon, I felt... This is my book. I'm going to write what I want. So, for example, when I would think of a strange character and he had adventures, I would say Stasny Panenka and his perfumed hammer. And whenever a person has read that, they always chuckle, not having any idea whatsoever what's meant by that, but it's just a giggle to see perfumed hammer. And in that sense, if you're going to define Dada as giving us a kind of wonderful slap to the face. Yes, that's what I'm trying to do in that book. That book more than the others. The others are not more solemn, but they're more grounded on earth. That one was just take the gloves off and fight barefisted with your imagination.
It gave me enormous pleasure, you know, to read a book like that that's so constantly getting itself off the ground.
Yeah, I mean, I had fun writing it. I've had... That, of all my books, has been the most controversial, however. I've run into a lot of trouble with different people who, as far as I'm concerned, ain't reading it the right way. Not that there's a right way to read it, but when, for example, someone comes to you and says, this is obviously a subversive da-da-da-da book, you know, you kind of go into the file cabinet of your mind and say, are we talking about the same thing? And then you go through the files to that book, which you wrote some years ago, and you look at it and you go, no, I mean, I didn't mean it to be this way at all. Not that that means anything. Sometimes what you mean and what develops is something else. But it's been a very controversial book, both here and overseas.
Well, to some extent, the book, which is about a woman who begins to escape into a fantasy land in her dreams named Rondua, and to meet people, in fact, who... perhaps because of their contact with her, are having similar dreams. The dreams generate a lot of dread in her, and so do other experiences in her life, the first dread generator being her abortion. And I'd imagine what you talk about in terms of the controversy is what might be the reading that she is being in some sense punished for having aborted a child. And you say that that's the wrong reading. I don't think that the book hinges on that matter, but it doesn't seem to me that the book is a pro-life book.
No, it's certainly not a pro-life book. I'm not. That's not the intent. What I intended, the two things that get me in trouble with that book is that I, as a man, wrote in the voice of a woman, first person, and the other thing is that a woman has an abortion and feels uncomfortable with it. But there are, I think John Berryman once said, we have so few chances to find out whether or not we'd be heroes in this life. And to extend that to another level, we have so few profound experiences in our life. When we come to them, we don't always handle them the way that we want or would expect ourselves to handle them. So, for example, if a woman has an abortion, whether she feels utterly justified or not, it's a very, very big moment in her life. When a parent dies or a child is born or some life and death, things like that, we are so unprepared for this kind of enormous activity, both psychic and intellectually, that we rarely handle it. We handle it, but we don't always handle it very well. And well meaning, to my own mind, I didn't handle that well. Maybe somebody else thinks you were right. In the book, for example, she has an abortion and she feels uncomfortable with it. And everybody around her, rightly so, says, you should have aborted the child. It was proper and the only right thing to do, but she feels uncomfortable. Very often in our own lives, we do things and everybody says, you were right. But do we feel that? No, not the way we wish that we could feel, the way our friends feel about our action.
Well, it seemed to me that her discomfort is personal. It's not that consciously she would like to have that child. It's just that it is like a grain of sand disturbing the oyster. A whole network of thoughts gather around that event for her and enter her dream life. The books are enfolded almost with road signs in a way, saying that they are literary. One of them, two of them actually, have epigraphs from John Ashbery poems. Others include epigraphs from Garcia Marquez, from Lampedusa. You are a literary writer, it seems, yeah? Bookworm. Who are the inspiration points when you sit down to write?
I feel a great debt to the South Americans, certainly. They were the first ones that I read back in college, and I love your term popcorn. I mean, those were the guys who suddenly were doing popcorn in my brain. I go, gee whiz. I mean, here's a guy who's discovering ice and a book that you can read six different ways and all of which are effective. And basically, as you know, in our education, we were taught the classics, but most of the classics followed a certain line. And suddenly when I came up against these, let's call them experimenters, certainly successful experiments, I went, you can do anything you want, so long as you do it well. You can do whatever you want. So they had an enormous influence on me. The other people who come to mind are people like Robertson Davies, writing Deptford Trilogy, which to me is an enormously important series of books, because I saw each, you have three books, each one can be read separately for what it is, but they also have this kind of interplay, so that if you've read the first one, the second one becomes richer, etc., etc. And also, I think, to me, probably the most beautiful writer in America today is James Salter. And I reread Salter's novel, Light Years, every year, just, you know, like going back for a course in college.
It's so good, and a sport and a pastime.
Exactly.
Great books. Chapters of his memoir have appeared in Grand Street and in Esquire, and they've been, you know, incredibly beautiful, very wonderful writer. Not at all experimental.
No. But I mean, again, I think that reading a book that matters to you, one of the first things for me is to just leap into the language that the guy is using. It doesn't matter whether it's down to earth or experimental or whatever, you just can't get enough of the way the guy spins his sentences. And for me, Salter describing a dinner in the country is, I suppose this is sacrilege, but I'd rather read that than read Turgenev's same thing, because of the fact I feel closer to Salter and it's more of a warmth in my own experience.
The books are filled with what, for lack of a better word, one might call whimsy, and what you might call the charm that you put in the spin on a sentence. From the very beginning of, for instance, A Child Across the Sky, in its very first sentence, two characteristic things happen. An hour before he shot himself, my best friend, Philip Strayhorn, called to talk about thumbs. Ever noticed when you wash your hands how you don't really do your thumbs? Well, immediately there's a kind of sweetly whimsical idea coupled with the fact that this person has committed suicide, and it seems to me that those are the valence points of these books, that there's a kind of imaginative frenzy going on of people who work their heads off to have odd ideas, and at the same time, these odd ideas have led them to the point of death.
I've been accused more than once of being cute in my writing, but that may be, I don't know. But I know too that almost always cute, it's like a hot air balloon. Cute is floating up there, but it's held down to the earth very, as far as I'm concerned, as the observer of what I'm writing, by a rather sad and in some cases tragic reality. You know, somebody can spin a beautiful phrase, but they're so desperately flawed that you love them for the phrase but you pity them terribly, and that's what I was trying to do at the beginning. You know, this, the whole first scene of that book is a guy calls up with a funny sort of strange idea and they have a chit chat, and then 1 minute later the guy blows his brains out, which is so stunning and shocking to me. why didn't you, it's almost as if, why didn't you call me up and say, I'm desperate, I don't know what to do, I'm going to kill myself, and my role is to say, no, don't do it. You may go and do it, but at least when I find out that you've done it, it's logical to me. But if you called up and you asked for my recipe for chocolate chip cookies and then you jumped out the window, this is far more hideous and more shocking than the everyday stuff that we hear about. You know, Joe wrote a suicide note and then he killed himself, as opposed to...
And, you know, it reminded me a bit. Do you know the American poet Weldon Keyes?
Sure.
Yeah. Over a period of time, I spoke to two people who spoke to Keyes, one several days before and one the very day he disappeared. These were Hugh Kenner and Pauline Kael. And I think to myself, how could it be, you know, that a really clearly haunted, funny, desperate guy like Keyes could call them up and have them have no idea that he was about to disappear absolutely from the face of the earth, but each of them remembering that it had afterwards the feel of a final conversation.
Yeah, I think that's true. Unfortunately, we have grown up in an environment which is so dramatic that we expect it to be movie-like, and it's not. It's hi, can I have your recipe for chocolate chip cookies? And then bang.
This character leaves behind, in A Child Across the Sky, a set of videotapes and a short story that he's considered to be his next project. He's a film director, director of the Bloodstone series, and he leads his characters through a network of revelations. The epigraph, I think it's from Garcia Marquez, says that it would be better for people not to leave things behind for their friends. Now, this is very much the way the novelist guides the reader through all of these books, as a kind of... For experimental fiction, there is a strong Perils of Pauline kind of cliffhanger quality to these books, but it's almost sadistic. You know, there's the quality of, no, I can't stop reading this book now. The author is twisting my arm behind my back. Now, that's certainly intentional.
Sure, it's intentional, but I'll tell you quite honestly, very often, people find this hard to believe, I don't know what's coming next. I just know, for example, a guy gets a videotape from his friend and he says, watch this videotape because it will explain to you why this happened. And then it doesn't explain, but it sort of explains. I mean, I watched the big episode of Twin Peaks the other day. I thought it was very clever because they sort of tell you who the murderer is, which they had advertised. On the other hand, you scratch his head and go, huh? And I let's use your term, it is sadistic in the sense of they told us they were going to tell us, and they sort of did tell us, but I'm still confused. And if I can do that in my stuff, then all the better. I mean, you're in the ring with me as a reader, and sometimes you're the better boxer and sometimes I am. But I got some tricks, and, you know, I've got a whammy punch which may not knock you down, but I'm hoping that I'll catch you at a moment so that you're stunned. And I mean that in the truest fighter sense of the word, you know. Even bums often surprise with their knockout punch.
Like William Volman, you're an American writer who's being published first in Europe, and Americans are actually always a book behind.
Right.
How did that come about?
I had a wonderful editor in England who sort of began my career with my first book, Land of Laughs, which in this country went right over the cliff. It came out and disappeared into the great void. And this guy, as is so often the case with books that disappear quickly, he was a kind of trumpet. He would go around and he said, this book is good and it should be read and I'm going to keep it in print and this and that. And go back to that old funny word, it became a kind of cult thing and has always been in print in England and is now in print in 13 languages, which is a really interesting thing to me because here people who've read it like it, but outside of the country, it's people like it very much. And so I just go where the sunshine is in this context. You know, I mean, the Brits buy a lot of my books, so I contract with them first right now and say, this is the kind of book I want to write, and we set it up. And then usually when I've finished, then I go to America and I say, you know, would you like to do it? Although with Doubleday, I've just signed a multiple contract, which is both comforting and alarming at the same time.
You're living in Vienna, too. Mm-hmm. And yet the books are not what I think of as European. They're neither austere on the one hand, nor are they arcane in their diction, the way certain European novelists, the style is not Byzantine as a writing style. Do you feel, you know, the classical sorrow of the exile?
No. I find it very, very difficult to come back to America now. I usually come back at the most for 2 weeks. And I don't feel like an exile. I don't feel like an expatriate. I loathe those words. I just feel, you know, it's when you find your home, you stay there. And it can be in Mozambique or it can be in Michigan. And I just, for better or worse, I found my home 18 years ago in Vienna and have, I don't like the Viennese, but I love Vienna. Until that changes, I'll stay there. It's also, as I've said so often before, it's the last 1930s city, I think, on the face of the earth, in the sense that you can go there and still feel like you're in an old Hitchcock film. It's changing now because of the opening of the East, but it's still got a lot of that spooky dazzle, which I like a lot.
You come from a film and music family. And this is something I guess I have always wanted to ask someone. You know, I came from a family in which my being a bookworm and a writer type was completely off the face of the earth. Isn't it an advantage to come from people who know something of what you're up to?
It is and it isn't. I mean, until I was 15, I was dead set against ever writing because my father was a screenwriter and et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of books around, but at the same time, there's a lot of competition. One of my brothers is a composer, and my other brother is a writer, and you know, I was a juvenile delinquent until I was 15. Literally, I was in jail because that was my way of reacting against it. Your way of reacting against it is to go in the direction of the light. Mine was to go in the direction of the shadow because I wasn't going to be like them.
I've been talking to Jonathan Carroll, the author of A Child Across the Sky, published by Doubleday, Sleeping in Flames, recently in paperback from Vintage, and the book that brings him here, Bones of the Moon, recently published in paperback by Avon. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.